Hi there, this is Wafala Bedat. You're listening to the Woman Power Podcast, a subsidiary platform to the Woman Power Summit, the largest event in MENA, with the aim of empowering women and helping them achieve their absolute highest potential. Each week on the Woman Power Podcast, you will hear honest, vulnerable, authentic, real conversations from inspiring women. These women will share their experiences and stories into what it takes to build a successful business and career. The podcast will share insight and inspiration and hopefully inspire action and lead change. Amel Jaffer is a solopreneur and yoga inner connections teacher. Yoga and mindfulness played a pivotal role in her journey battling breast cancer. Today, Amel shares her journey of how she navigated this incredibly tough space, but also how she practiced adventure surrender, a life theme that reminds her to follow her heart, trust, and intuition. Welcome, Amel.
How have you been during these strange times with COVID?
COVID's been interesting. It's been a very, very big blessing for me, actually. Within COVID, I found quiet and I found space. And I remember at the beginning, it was 1 week to adjust myself and my work to the new setup. I had a day of complete freak out because I usually teach in person, and what am I going to do and how am I going to set things up? And it's challenging because I'm my own boss. I have my own setup. So no one was telling me, what to do. I had to take decisions on and make decisions on my own. Freaked out, noticed that I was freaking out. And then I just decided to pull my whiteboard, start writing things down, putting things into action, and have a plan. And then I had a plan, and then I went through. So that's with regards to work. And then on a more personal and social level, I didn't used to go out much anyway. I love my home. I live in a beautiful, colorful apartment, so I just started to enjoy it more. In general, it's been good. It's been good. Last year was really lovely. I found the space to do to join some programs that brought me back to my heart and revived this deep, juicy inner connection that I have with myself. So it's been a blessing.
It's crazy. Yeah. I've seen different people react to this experience so differently. So it's either a blessing or a curse, and it's a real test of your mental strength. And if you're able to, like you said, kind of take a step back and, make the most out of it, it could actually work in your favor. I've seen people just lose so much weight, become healthy, just have a great routine. And I've seen people completely become paranoid, panicky, haven't left the house in so long. Like, it's just crazy to see the different dynamics and of what this experience has done to people. But I'm glad that you've put a plan and you've committed and you've turned it into a gift, basically.
Yeah. And I think the key was to not fight what's happening. And I've had my firsthand experience when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I know what it's like to be really angry and afraid and oppose what you're going through. And then also have the choice to just surrender to some part of it, to go with the flow, to tap into your inner wisdom. For me, it was really, really key not to just accept this situation as this is how it is, and I'm going to adapt accordingly.
So, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because obviously this is what I would love to focus on in this episode. You're a survivor of breast cancer, and I wanted to just kind of deep dive into your journey and your experience. I'm just going through all the emotions, starting from, how did you get the news, or how did you find out, or did you feel like something was wrong?
Well, so it started in February 2018. I was just checking my body, and I found a lump. And it was strange. I hadn't felt that there before. And when my first thought was, ooh, that's strange. Ooh, what's the worst thing that might happen? And the next thought was, well, if it's breast cancer, just immediately jumped into that. If it's breast cancer, then it's okay. It's highly treatable these days. And breast cancer patients have one of the highest survival rates in the world and among diseases. So it will be handled. It'll be managed. This was just a few months before I got married. So I was occupied with the wedding and putting together, you know, like just setting up my new place and everything and just getting, and all the anxiety related to getting married. And I waited. I was hoping it would disappear, this weird thing that I felt in my body, this new thing, and it didn't. After one cycle, it didn't. And then I started to look into seeing a doctor. I wasn't sure where to go. I did some research online. It was just all vague, and I was navigating most of this alone. I was afraid of sharing this with people because I didn't want people around me, my mother especially, to freak out. Fast forward into having an ultrasound. They still can't rule anything out, and the doctors asked for a biopsy. And I told the doctor, well, I'm getting married in 2 weeks. Can I wait? Can you give me some time? And she said, come the week after your wedding. Like, have your 1 week of honeymoon.
How are you able to compartmentalize that and experience your wedding and your honeymoon? I would be thinking the whole time, like, or were you able to separate the two?
Because I wasn't afraid. At that stage, I had no evidence that it might be cancer. All I knew is there's something. And most of the people who were running tests on me, the doctors, technicians, etc., they all just said, it's probably nothing. You're young. You have no history in your family. So it wasn't a high possibility. That's why it was just easy to go like, okay, well, the doctor said I can wait, so I'll wait. So just put a pause on that, had a beautiful wedding. And then the week after I had the biopsy, and a few days later we got a call. And when you get a call and they ask you to come instead to the hospital instead of delivering news, on the phone, there's probably something. I remember I was sitting in the hospital at the doctor's clinic, and there was the doctor and two other doctors and a practicing someone, like a nurse or a doctor, and just all these people, and me and my husband. And the doctor took forever to deliver the news, which I found really, really frustrating, because she was tiptoeing around delivering, you know, the findings. And then she said, it's a malignant tumor, so it's cancerous, and this is what needs to be done. I broke into tears. I was sobbing. We got into, you know, the practicals of things. They sent me down to do a mammogram. And as I was walking out of the mammogram room, I was thinking, oh, am I one of them? Am I a cancer patient now? Is this who I am? Like, I just immediately felt like I entered into a pool of people that I had no connection with before, with the full stereotype of, because they said I had to do chemo. So that was terrifying. And as I kept walking, I heard a voice inside of me say, no, this is not gonna label you. This is not gonna define you. You're not a cancer patient, you're still you. This is part of your journey, and you'll deal with it. And that was a very pivotal moment early on in the journey, And that's something that I carried with me the whole time to date. I don't like to be labeled as a cancer survivor. And even when I had the tumor, I just didn't feel real to be labeled as a cancer patient. I was scared. I was really, really scared of chemo. I had dark thoughts, but then I started to express them. And when I felt heard, it was very soothing. In general, so what I did is just for everyone's reference, so the lump was at stage one. And I had to do around five months of chemotherapy. Then a small surgery called a lumpectomy, where they remove the site of the tumor. And then I had to do radiotherapy for around a month.
What has been the hardest part? I mean, I'm sure it's all really hard, but what has been like the most challenging moment of this whole experience?
The hardest part was that they put me on an induced temporary menopause to protect my ovaries, and I started to have hot flashes, and all the symptoms, not all, but like many of the symptoms that women who go through menopause go through, that was the toughest experience out of everything. Chemo was manageable. I joined a support group, a local support group, and the ladies were lovely, and I was receiving tips all the time. And there were challenges. The nausea was challenging. The not knowing what to eat is challenging. But that extreme physical experience of intense heat running through my body and not knowing what to do about it, how to deal with it, was really, really tough. I found that the things that were happening on a mind level and emotional level were manageable because I've been trained to do it. My yoga experience, my studies, the courses I've done, all the mindfulness, you know, knowledge I have came into that experience and helped me manage my thoughts to some extent. But it's that physical experience that was really tough.
How did, you know, you've obviously recovered from this experience. How did it feel to kind of, I don't want to say you're like, we're fully healed from this, because you have to keep checking and make sure that you're good every 6 months. You know, it's a really, I don't want to say strange disease, but it, like, you know, you don't know if it creeps back up on you. And so there's always this, you know, I got to get checked. But when you kind of overcame at least this stage where you're like, okay, I'm good for now, you know, how did it feel towards the end when you're wrapping up from your chemo and you're getting good news from the doctor? Did that feel surreal? Did you then have like a meltdown because you were so strong for so long and you finally could just, you know what I mean? Because sometimes I feel like the grieving and that hits you afterward.
Exactly, it does. I knew that the tumor was gone before the doctor told me. Just 1 month after receiving chemo, the tumor shrunk immediately. And in that same month, I had a huge realization of what the emotional reason might have been behind this tumor coming up. Like, I just had that revelation. So when the doctor delivered the news, I was like, yeah, I know. I know I'm healed. I know I'm good. It was nice. It was happy. It validated me to hear that from the doctor, and it gave me a chance to celebrate the good news with my friends and with my family. But as you said, the grieving hits right after everything was over. So after radiotherapy, I found myself alone all of a sudden. Instead of visiting the doctor once or twice a week, it was the doctor appointments were way, you know, far apart. And people just didn't ask me about my treatment anymore or how I felt. There was almost an expectation of, oh, you're good now, right? You're good. So we don't need to talk about that. But I felt lonely. and alone. And I started to really notice this change that has happened in my body. And then a few months after that, I started to have really intense anxiety attacks, which I then realized that all my life I had anxiety attacks. I didn't know they're called anxiety attacks. I thought I was crazy. That's the label I used to give myself. But then when I realized that, the thing is, what happened, I think, is there's something that got uncovered throughout that journey. My heart was open with all the love and compassion that just bloomed in my heart ever since, more and more and more, but also with that heart opening, there's a lot of grief that came. There's this transparency of my emotions. So it's no longer about a story that is external about something else. It's no longer anger or frustration. There was fear and grief, and it's coming through as anxiety.
The following episode is brought to you by Al-Usra's Ode to an initiative that is close to all our hearts. In light of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we bring you stories of real women who've been affected by breast cancer and share their experiences of coping with the disease and finding support. Emotive and comforting, we aim to spread awareness, and through a shared message of empowerment, we're bringing forth women to share their journey with cancer, overcoming it with the utmost courage and helping the community raise awareness with their inspiring stories. Notably, an Usra's collaboration with ThinkPick Society will focus on meaningful initiatives like D4D, Distance for a Dinar campaign, to help involve the community in a creative way considering the ongoing COVID restrictions, a nutrition guide to spread awareness on the healthy options Al-Usra offers for their diet, and the sale of the tote bags, whose profits from the sales will go towards a Think Pink Society. For all the latest updates on their campaign, follow Al-Usra on Instagram at Al-Usra Supermarket.
Do you wish someone told you something about this or prepared you for this in advance? As in, you know, looking back, I wish I knew something, that maybe no one kind of transferred that knowledge to you, or you didn't find it in a book. Like, what do you wish you knew before this whole experience?
I think I knew everything I needed to know. I think I had to go through this from where I was. And I don't think that I needed a shortcut. One little like minor thing that I wish I knew is that, and that's what I tell people now when they tell me they're going to receive chemo, is that chemotherapy is manageable. It's not the end of the world. It's the most, it's a bizarre treatment. I can't find the word right now. There was a word I used to describe it with. It's not so advanced. It's harsh. It's ridiculous that you know, just infuse that into the whole body to treat a small part. And yes, people lose their hair and they feel weak and nauseous, but it's manageable. It's not the end of things. And with certain tips we can learn and ask about, then we can manage the side effects.
How do you wish people or your support groups or your friends and family would behave around you? Like, I know for some people it's awkward for them. They don't know how to like even process the information. They'll either pretend nothing is happening, they might avoid you, they might, you know, feel sorry for you, which is not what you want. Like, how can, if someone is around someone who's going through this really challenging experience, how would you recommend they behave or support that person?
For me, it was important to be treated with love and care and openness, and to remember everything that I am. I'm this, you know, wholesome being. I'm not just someone who's going through a cancer journey. So that for me meant sharing news with me and stories and celebrating my birthday and anniversaries and doing fun things together, just having a normal life. And And I loved, I did receive that from my friends, my close friends and my family to a certain extent. But being treated that way from by my husband was the, especially that we had just gotten married, was very assuring, very, very, very assuring. And it gave me a chance to switch off sometimes. What I also did is I communicated to my family that over a meal, we don't talk about this. So I set some boundaries that at this time, we don't talk about this. We just talk about normal stuff. We're not going to consume all our time talking about this specific, you know, disease or like who's gotten it or what's going to happen next. Yeah, to just do that, to just be normal and offer love and openness, and ask how do you feel? What can I do for you?
Looking back on your life pre, you know, going through this experience, you know, I'm sure a lot of problems seem so small and trivial now. So how have you decided to live your life differently? As in like, oh, I don't, you know, I used to have road rage and now I don't care if I'm stuck in traffic, or like, you know, I don't get mad at anybody anymore. Like, I don't want to hold a grudge. Like, that's just, you know, because I feel like everything just kind of just shrinks. Like, you know, this is your life and your health, and that's like the most important thing. And like, everything just kind of reprioritizes.
Yeah. My sense of compassion has deepened immensely. My compassion for myself, for my loved ones, for people I don't know, for animals, insects, for the planet, for just everyone and everything. My sense of compassion has deepened immensely. And also my sense of playfulness and lightness has just widened. So I take things less seriously now. I laugh a lot. I laugh at my own trauma that came after this journey. Sometimes I'd have like a cramp somewhere or like a zit in a weird place and I freak out. The first thought is, oh my God, what if it's cancer again? And then I laugh at how I'm reacting to things.
Let's talk about something really powerful you said, which is, you know, you were so prepared for this because of your yoga, like your yoga and your breathing, and that just mental strength was there for you to be able to handle, you know, cancer. And my question to you is, like, let's take a step back. Like, how did you fall in love with yoga, and how did you make the decision that this was going to be your full-time kind of career?
I didn't make a decision. The decision was made. I just found myself there. Well, it started in 2011. I found myself walking into Namaste, it's a yoga studio in Bahrain, and I just fell in love. I had gone to yoga classes before with different teachers and never really enjoyed it. And because I'm naturally flexible, I was like, well, it's easy, not challenging enough. I don't need to do this. But at Namaste, I found depth, and I soon realized that yoga is not just about the body. It's a wholesome practice. And the more I practiced, the calmer I became. I used to get angry very easily, frustrated very easily. The road rage you mentioned, was, yeah, it was frequent during that time. And the more I practiced, the more grounded I felt, the calmer I was, the softer I felt. And I loved how I felt in my body. And 2 years after, Namaste offered a teacher training. And I decided I'll just go ahead and do it advance my practice, to deepen my own personal practice. I had no intention of teaching. And it's a 20-day program. By day four, I was in love with teaching. Graduated the training, started teaching immediately. And at the time, I was in a corporate job. I was in a really big company in Bahrain, in the marketing team. And I used to love my job. I was in advertising and marketing for 9 years, really, really passionate about it. It was creative, it's fun. And a few months after teaching, I one evening realized that I was no longer in love with what I was doing. I just didn't feel passion for it anymore. And I was having a chat with a friend, telling him about that. And in that same conversation, I was fantasizing about leaving my job and traveling around. And that's what I did. Left my job a few months later, went to India. I had this really long trip planned to go to India and Bali and I don't know where, but mesmerizing India just kept me in her arms for 4 months. And when I came back, it was my calling. I didn't choose to continue to teach yoga, but it's where I found myself. And I've been doing this. I've been teaching ever since.
I've heard this type of story before, you know, a person working in corporate, just like going at such a very speedy rate, not really having time to check in with themselves to figure out, okay, what is my compass? Experiencing yoga, leaving their jobs, going to India or to Bali or one of these countries, completely pivoting their career, coming back to teach or create their own yoga studios or just go into that wellness space. So why does that happen to people? Like, you know, why do you feel, you know, that, you know, women, or not just women, but like, how, why do you feel that that's like, there's a certain, I don't want to say it's cliche in a bad way, but it, you know, you hear about these, that progression and that journey happen, and then it leads into the yoga practice.
My personal answer is that it's very empowering to know that a corporate entity doesn't have to control my life, doesn't have to limit what I do and what I decide for myself. And to learn that my self-worth and image and my self-worth is and sense of success is not directly a result of what the KPIs and appraisals and all of those things say. It's freeing. I felt that the corporate environment, my experience in the corporate world was that it was very fake. I didn't want to wear shoes. I used to walk around the office saying, I hate shoes. I still hate shoes. I hate shoes. I don't want my feet to be covered. I want to work in a job where I'm barefoot. That same company had a semi-Sharia compliant dress code. It really frustrated me. I wanted to wear whatever I wanted to wear. I didn't feel like that affected my work. So I think that for me, that was a very big distinction between working as in part in that environment, which is also, it can be quite toxic and political and tense and fake in so many ways. There's a lot of pretending and a lot of, I call it lying, and versus in the way I do my work, there, it's rooted in authenticity, rooted in genuinity. And I show up as myself fully. And it's very close, it's very intimate work. It's very personal and intimate work. And that's why I'm still lingering here.
When you came back and you decided, okay, I'm going to teach, you were certified, you know, how was everybody's feedback? Like, I mean, I have a father who's like, you should still go to banking, right? Like, get a job and, you know, get insurance. So how was your environment's feedback? Like, oh my God, Emma, you're going to quit your job. What are you going to do? Teach yoga? Did you feel like there was judgment, or did you actually feel like it was more supportive?
It was a mix of all of that. A lot of people's reaction was, oh, I wish I can do that. And these were mostly married men with children in corporate who said, I wish I could do that. Some people were excited, and some people expressed their fear. My family wasn't very accepting of this decision to quit my job, a really good job, and travel. And when reality hit, when I came back and it was very clear that this is what I'm going to do, There was a lot of friction. I was still living with my parents at the time, and there was a lot of friction about this, that, you know, we sent you abroad to university, you have a degree, how can this happen? And how are you gonna, they were worried about my income and just all of that. And I found that really frustrating, because that was another attachment that I had, that there was a deep want in me to be accepted by them. So that was a journey that I had to go through. But eventually things just fell into place.
So can we talk about that attachment?
Yes.
Just because I feel like that's possibly everyone's story, like not just here, but in the world, which is I want to be accepted by my family who have raised me and have spent money on my education, and I owe it to them. Or, you know, my husband never signed up for this, for me to want to travel and do something completely different, which could mean also maybe being a temporary burden on other people while you figure this stuff out. How do you deal with that? Like, I know for me, in order to push back against the idea of getting a job and starting my own business, I've had to cut my father out of my life, as in, like, we're not speaking until I actually do this, because the negativity was so emotionally exhausting, I couldn't fight both battles. So I've had to, like, cut my father off from, like, just verbally speaking to him. Or if the subject came up, I would have to leave the room, just, like, really gently. But yeah, I've had to just, you know, put that on hold until my business was up and running and I had the capacity to emotionally exchange and have these discussions. So what did you have to do to really fight for your dream and to give it some breathing room for it to kickstart?
One, I had to be financially independent. So when I left, I already had savings. I had enough money. I could have lived 5 years on my savings. Something that my mom taught me to do, ironically, but she taught me to do this. So I've been saving since day one in my first job. So when I went and I stood in front of my parents and I said, this is what I'm doing, I wasn't asking for anything other than, you know, well, I didn't even want to live in the same house. Not because I don't like them, but I was 32 at the time and I wanted to move out, but Bahrain's challenging. That's another story. So this is what happened. This is the moment where things shifted. One, when I decided that this is what I was going to do, and I was telling them, it was an FYI. I was not asking for permission. I knew deep inside, I knew that I have the full right to, it wasn't even questionable that I have the right to do this or not. I know, it's just non-negotiable. So it was an FYI, this is what I'm going to do. And what I learned from yoga is that people's reactions are their own reactions. It has nothing to do with me. I can make it personal, but it doesn't. It's their story. It's where they're coming from. It's their own perspective. So to a certain extent, I didn't internalize that. The challenge was there was still an attachment deep down inside. Like, after a while, I realized that. And I remember one day having this really heated discussion with my mom about this. And I'm really close to my mom. Love her to bits. And today she loves what I do. And, like, she vouches for me. But at the time, she wasn't very comfortable with this. And I pushed her to the point where she said, I'm disappointed in you. And when I heard that, it was the most painful thing to hear, but in that same moment, here's the monster I'm afraid of, and it's right here, and it's been stated, it's in my face, and it almost felt like there was an explosion, and then things just settled in. Because I heard it, I was no longer afraid. I serve it just, okay, she said she's disappointed in me. Well, that's her story, not mine. I was able to respond to it from that same perspective. So for me, that's that. I feel like it's really important to set boundaries. That you did that when you cut your father off for a while. For me, this is my way of setting boundaries, is not to discuss things in detail, to give general updates when I want to, and again, remove myself from the room when I no longer want to discuss things.
So you really stood up. Sorry, this is a great potential title, like how to stand up for your dream. Because I feel like you were just like, I'm not asking for permission. You clearly had a plan.
No plan, Wafa. Just following my gut feeling from one step to the other. When I went to India, I had planned my first two stops. I had no idea what I'll be doing the rest of it. I stayed in an ashram. I did a 10-day silent meditation course, Vipassana. I did another teacher. I had no idea I was going to do that. Came back, had no idea. There was no plan. And I think that's what was frustrating also for my parents, is what are you going to do? And it was just, for me, it was moment by moment, day by day, month by month.
We could not have been more delighted to have Al-Usra to be part of our growing podcast family and its long-standing initiative to support breast cancer awareness. Al-Usra is your local friendly supermarket that aims to offer its customers a personal shopping experience with a unique mix of local and international premium brands and quality foods. Al-Usra aims to create a safe space and build a community for women warriors who've conquered breast cancer and are on the journey of defeating it. Empowerment and encouragement are values that are deeply rooted in our platform. And thanks to Al-Usra, we're realizing our goal to help women raise awareness and shatter misconceptions around breast cancer. In addition to that, Al-Usra is also collaborating with Think Pink Society to raise awareness on different initiatives like the D4D, Distance for a Dinar campaign, a nutrition guide curated by a nutritionist from Think Pink Society to approve the fresh, clean products they sell and make in their kitchen. And lastly, the sale of tote bags, whose profits from the sales will go towards the Think Pink Society. To know more about the breast cancer campaign, follow Al-Usra on Instagram at Al-Usra Supermarket.
So when did things kind of start to become less abstract and you were like, okay, I kind of see a plan now?
It's constantly happening. It's constantly happening. I think a year after I came back, it just became very clear, because I was still trying to get a part-time job in corporate in some capacity, and that wasn't happening. If there is a divine plan, and if there is a divine, then the divine was saying, well, girl, you're not going to go there. You're staying on this route. You're teaching yoga. And I would get way more opportunities to do to teach yoga than the freelance, translation or marketing work I was doing, the part-time stuff. So with time, I would stop, look back and go like, oh, this is what I've been doing. And then the next year, again, I'd look back and say, okay. So, and with time, I gave myself permission to say, I'm a full-time yoga teacher. I'm a self-employed yoga teacher. It's a gradual process. It doesn't just happen all of a sudden.
So working for yourself or being a solopreneur, where you're also kind of finding your own clients, you're marketing, you are managing your own money, are you enjoying it? Does it suit your personality? Is there something that you're working towards, or you're like, this is what it looks like for me and I'm comfortable with this business model?
I like my setup right now. It really works for me. I love the freedom of working at my own pace and on my own. I do partner with colleagues and with different entities from time to time. But I love this freedom and space that I have. Because I work on my own, when I used to work with a group of people, there's feedback. We reflect with each other. There's feedback. There is a degree of validation. But when I work on my own, imposter syndrome is more likely to show up. And that's a challenge to manage. But with time, I've learned to embrace my own setup. And I've learned to do things in a way that suits me. So a few years ago, I had this big obsession with the next step, and the next step is to have a yoga studio. And then I realized that I didn't want that. I'm not passionate about it. I was just doing it because I thought I saw other people do it and that be a success story for them. But it doesn't necessarily have to be my story. I love my setup right now. I'm able to take time off whenever I want to, and change things the way I want. So it's fun. Comfortable.
You know, that's been such a big theme for this podcast over and over again, just like this idea of scaling down, which is we think we should be bigger, we should have more people, we should grow by X percent. And for some people, they're very much driven by that. I'm someone who's extremely driven by that, but it's not, you do it for your own reasons, not because, oh, it seems like everybody's going down this direction. And actually, something I've learned in EO, which is an entrepreneurship forum that I'm a part of, is just like, you know, everybody wants to be a $1 billion company, but then you realize that like that's so corporate and that's so structured that you lose that startup feel. So actually some people stop at a certain stage. They're like, we're happy with the size we are now and this is what we're comfortable with. So it's this idea of we don't all have to be, you know, starting the yoga studios or hiring all the yoga teachers, but it's what works for your personality. And I think that's also quite a pivotal moment for someone to realize this makes me happy and that's okay. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important to keep checking in with the messages. For me, it's about the messages that come from within, from like this nice, where's my intuition guiding me? What's this inner voice within me guiding me to do, to offer? And when something, an opportunity shows up that on paper looks great and like my mind is saying, yes, go for it. It's good. There's really good money in that and it's going to give you prestige and like validate you. But I have like resistance towards it, or I'm not feeling passionate about it. It's important to listen to those little cues and signals from within to navigate what you want to do.
I know that, you know, when you talked about chemo, you talked about losing your hair and just, you know, you lose all your facial hair, your eyebrows. I want to talk a bit about identity and just as somebody who has given birth a year ago, I've had a huge, and I guess that is postpartum, it's also identity crisis, which is like, who am I if I don't look like the person I think I do? And then, you know, on top of that, just like losing your appetite or your whole schedule changes and, you know, you have body pain. You are just, everything that made you is no longer there. So you're like upset because it's like, nothing is reminding me of me. So how do you, this is in no way a comparison to what you went through, but I'm trying to find like a moment of connection, which is how do you find yourself again after going through like a physical or a mental change that's tough or harsh?
I love that you brought this up, Wafa, because it's a very important point and it's a very intimate experience. Going through an experience like this is very similar to, I haven't been pregnant, but I know it's very similar to being pregnant and giving birth. And I wrote a lot about that. I have poems and poems about reflecting on this very point. I think to answer your question of how do you find yourself, I think the answer is that you haven't lost yourself. Yourself is always there. It's just parts of the layers just temporarily go or disappear. All this facade, as pieces of the facade kept dropping, I was able to connect to my deep, 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 deep self, to my soul, really, 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 really deeply and in a very, 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 very intimate way. And I was able to express myself from that place, from that point, and give myself permission to be fully me. So one of the most beautiful things that happened when I was going through that experience is I started to sing better. I always used to sing very casually. It's just for fun. I sing every day. But my voice, the quality of my voice just changed and shifted. And I was singing more, posting more singing videos, expressing my truth more, whether it was pleasant or not. So it's always there. It's always there. And, you know, hair comes back or it doesn't, or like eyebrows come back or they don't. But
by the way, I got goosebumps when you said that, because I just felt like when the facade leaves, so when we physically change, I just felt like all that's left is our soul. I completely, like, I felt like it was like a, then it's like a fountain. Just like it has so much to say and do, because now, you know, you're not even bothered about any of the stuff anymore. You know what I mean? Not even bothered, but like you're not even, that's not what you're looking at anymore. You're looking at all this internal stuff, which is just a bit, it's a huge thought.
And what happened is that, so my relationship with myself didn't change. The way I was handling myself didn't change. I gave myself permission to be fully me. I didn't wear a wig. I tried to cover my head just because it's cute. And then all those hot flashes were just made it so uncomfortable. So I went out and I was bald most of the time, all the time. I was still teaching. I was still spending quality time with friends. And that those things, they can seem trivial, but they reflect my relationship with myself. I didn't want to keep myself in that box, in that bubble. And I just gave myself permission to just be all the things that I am. And to also see how I was just moving in this process. It felt like a process of birth, of like birthing a certain version of myself, the next version of myself.
I had another question, which was, you chose to share your journey online. Like I've known people who've gone through cancer and they've gone inward. So they've disappeared from social, they stopped being so responsive, and everybody has different coping methods. But what you did is you chose to share your journey, and by sharing content and photos of yourself, like you said, without a wig, and just you as you showing up and sharing parts of your journey, and just also being super accessible to share your story with anyone, I'm sure with the intention of helping as many people as possible. But why did you choose to be so visible and to share versus, okay, I'm going to switch all that noise off and I'm going to focus on myself, for example?
Again, I didn't decide. I found myself doing it. And I'm realizing that more and more and more. I'm really expressive. I love to express myself. When I feel safe enough, when I feel that I'm held and heard and understood and listened to, then my heart and throat open up and I just be. It's a way of being for me. So I just found myself sharing that news. I wasn't held back. I know that some people are held back by fear, by shame, by confusion, and those things weren't things that showed up for me. On the contrary, maybe there was a part of me that realized that by expressing, I was also healing. By expressing, and of course, by expressing, I'm also processing. By expressing, I'm relating and just making the realizations that I need to realize. And I'm offering in a very Brené Brown kind of way. I'm being vulnerable enough to open up and receive love and receive the care and that we all, you know, it's something that we all like.
You know, during COVID, it's crazy that you're talking about being expressive and just like being creative. And I felt that right after I gave birth, like all I wanted to do was write and journal and paint and draw. And I started this podcast as soon as I gave birth because I wanted to communicate and talk to people and get answers. And so it's amazing that these experiences like unlock this creative channel. Like we have so much to say and we want to share it with everyone. So, or just even experience that with ourselves. So I feel like there's always a gift when we go through these life-changing experiences. So I wanted to ask you, I love like wrapping up all my podcasts with this question, which is, what do you feel is your superpower?
Playfulness is my superpower. My ability to just laugh and play and not.
It takes us back to being children. I have a friend who was like, you know, sometimes I just play Lego for the whole day and I'm like, the whole, like how? You're like an adult. And you know, they just, they integrate these blocks of playfulness in their day where they get to just, so I think that's pretty awesome. Emel, thank you so much. This was wonderful. I have to say, I think your superpower is authenticity. Just showing up with yourself and your barefootness and your beautiful energy, like it's you really radiate, and I feel like it's because you're so aligned with who you're meant to be in this world. So I feel it. So it's brave. So thank you for doing that. And I think maybe when people are exposed to your content, they're also aware that, you know, they have to figure out what authenticity is to them. So I think you remind us all to try to get closer to that every day. So thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Wafan. Thanks for seeing me and for very eloquently articulating that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And it was lovely having this beautiful chat with you.
That's it for this week. Thank you for listening to an episode of the Woman Power Podcast. And thank you for downloading and streaming our podcast every week. If you love what you've heard, tag us on Instagram and follow the Woman Power Podcast and Woman Power Summit account for more information on our next episode. Please leave a rating review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps other women discover the show. That's it from me. See you next week.